From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, the MOVE bombing remembered. 15 years ago, Philadelphia police dropped a firebomb on the MOVE row house, incinerating 11 people in Philadelphia, six of them children. On this anniversary, the latest on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, featuring his recorded commentaries, also a conversation with bomb survivor Ramona Africa. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend marked the 15th anniversary of the Philadelphia police dropping a firebomb on the house of the MOVE organization. That bombing incinerated 11 people, six of them children. Ramona Africa is the only adult to have survived the firebomb.
Ramona Africa is the Minister of Information for the MOVE organization.
On the MOVE, and long live John Africa. Mumia is in prison on death row because he refused to stop telling the truth, because he wouldn't stop exposing the injustice and treachery of this system. And we ain't gonna sit back in silent frustration and watch them silence him permanently. We ain't gonna do it. We ain't gonna do it. We gonna fight with everything we got to save our brother and bring him home and make that a beginning.
Mumia Abu-Jamal.
8 years now since the massacre. 8 years since the carnage on Osage Avenue. 8 years since an urban holocaust which stole 11 human lives. 8 years since the unjust encagement of Ramona Africa for daring to survive. 8 years since the government committed premeditated mass murder of members of the Africa family. Men, women, and children, and still justice is a ghostly illusion. To date, no judge, no jury, no judicial nor law enforcement officer has condemned the May 13th bombing of MOVE. In fact, several, including former U.S. Attorney Edwin Meese and former Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates, have applauded it. For over 17 years now, I've written of the ongoing battles between MOVE and this system. I have seen every substantive so-called constitutional right twisted, shredded, and torn when it comes to MOVE. Since the early 1970s, I've seen male and female MOVE members beaten till bloody and bones broken, locked beneath the jails, caged while pregnant, beaten into miscarriage, starved by municipal decree, sentenced to a century in prisons, homes demolished by bomb, by crane, by cannon, by fire, but I've never seen them broken. Throughout this vicious state campaign, the government, the prosecutors, the police, the courts, have had one central aim: renounce MOVE, renounce your allegiance to John Africa, and we'll leave you alone. This has been proven. In 1978, a phalanx of 500 heavily armed cops laid siege to MOVE headquarters in Powelton Village in an alleged attempt to enforce a civil eviction order. During the shoot-in, a cop was killed, and all adult MOVE members inside were charged with murder. Before trial, two women told investigators they would resign from the organization even though they too were arrested inside the house. All charges, including murder, were dropped. At trial, 9 MOVE men and women were convicted of third-degree murder, and all were sentenced to 30 to 100 years in prison. The May 13, 1985 action was an attempt to draw attention to the earlier injustice suffered by MOVE members and demand their release. As to their innocence, one need go no further than the trial judge of the August 8th case, who told listeners of the popular Frank Ford talk show in Philadelphia just days after their conviction that he hadn't, quote, the faintest idea, unquote, who killed the cop, adding, quote, They were tried as a family, so I convicted them as a family, unquote. MOVE members then were convicted of being MOVE members. Had Ramona Africa emerged from the sea of flames wrapped in fear, had she not instead escaped with her aura of resistance intact, she would have been free long before the 7 years she spent in a hellhole. Her prosecutor, describing MOVE as a cult of resistance, demanded the jury convict her of a range of charges that, if they did so, would have exposed her to over 50 years in prison. Only her naturalist faith, the teachings of John Africa, allowed her to competently defend herself, where she beat the majority of the charges. Ramona is, quote unquote, free today. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, as the Million Mom March took place in Washington, D.C., with more than 500,000 people protesting against guns and violence, people in Philadelphia rallied for a different cause, the case of death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, this on the 15th anniversary of the MOVE bombing. Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist who sits on Pennsylvania's death row since 1982 after his conviction for the murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. That conviction has been contested on various constitutional, legal, and moral grounds ever since. The latest development in that case is that federal judge William H. Yon is soon expected to schedule an oral argument on whether Abu-Jamal will be granted an evidentiary hearing or whether the federal courts will review his case based solely on the Pennsylvania court state record developed by Judge Albert Szabo. If Judge Yon were to grant such a hearing, Abu-Jamal would be allowed to present evidence that was suppressed by the Pennsylvania courts during the course of his trial. Mumia Abu-Jamal and his supporters point out that witnesses in his trial changed their stories, allegedly under police pressure, that the jury had 11 qualified African Americans removed by peremptory challenges, that the prosecutor suppressed evidence and called for the death penalty, saying Abu-Jamal had been a Black Panther. Furthermore, his defense attorney did not interview a single witness. Abu-Jamal was not allowed to defend himself and was often banned from the courtroom during his trial. Today, we're going to hear some of the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal. For those who follow his case, and even those who don't, you might find it strange that he is rarely heard in this country, so often censored off of the mainstream media. Years ago, National Public Radio was going to run a series of his commentaries, but because of tremendous police pressure from the Fraternal Order of Police, though they denied it was because of the pressure, less than 24 hours before his commentaries were going to run, they were pulled from All Things Considered. In 1997, this program, Democracy Now!, began the airing of Mumia Abu-Jamal commentaries that we had recorded with the Prison Radio Project that's based in San Francisco. As we went to air with the first of those commentaries, the 12 public radio stations in Pennsylvania that aired Democracy Now!, all owned by Temple University, pulled Democracy Now! From the airwaves and have never broadcast us since. Today, we will hear not only Mumia Abu-Jamal, but we will also hear those who have stood up in his defense over the past year as the movement continues to grow to save his life.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a
grandfather, and an African American. I live in the fastest growing public housing tract in America. In 1981, I was a reporter for WUHY-FM and president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Currently, I'm a writer and public radio commentator. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. Tune in to hear my regular reports from death row. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Imagine living, eating, sleeping, relieving oneself, daydreaming, weeping, but mostly waiting in the room the size of your bathroom. Now imagine doing all those things, but mostly waiting for the rest of your life. Imagine waiting to die. I don't have to imagine. I live in one of those rooms, like about 3,000 other men and women in 38 states across the United States. It's called death row. I call it hell. Welcome to hell. Each of the states which have death rows have a different system for their execution cases, varying from the relatively open to the severely restrictive. Some states, like California and Texas, allow their execution cases work, education, and/or religious service opportunities for out-of-cell time up to 8 hours a day. Pennsylvania locks its execution cases down 23 hours a day, 5 days a week, 24 hours the other 2 days. At the risk of quoting Mephistopheles, I repeat, welcome to hell. A hell erected and maintained by human governments and blessed by black robe judges. A hell which allows you to see your loved ones, but not to touch them. A hell situated in America's boondocks, hundreds of miles away from most families. A white rural hell where most of the cage captives are black and urban. It is the American way of death. Contrary to what one might suppose, this hell is the easiest one to enter in a generally hellish criminal justice system. Why? Because unlike any other case, those deemed potential capital cases are severely restricted during the jury selection phase, as any juror who admits opposition to the death penalty is immediately and automatically removed, leaving only those who are fervent death penalty supporters in the pool of eligible jurors. When it is argued that to exclude those who oppose death and to include only those who supported death was fundamentally unfair, as the latter were more conviction prone, the United States Supreme Court, in a case titled Lockhart versus McCree, said such a claim was of no constitutional significance. Once upon a time, politicians promised jobs and benefits to constituents, like a chicken in every pot to get elected. It was a surefire vote getter. No longer. Today, the lowest level politico up to the president use another surefire gimmick to guarantee victory. Death. Promise death, and the election is yours. Guaranteed. Vraiment. A vote for hell in the land of liberty, with its over 1 million prisoners, is the ticket to victory. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Around the country over the last year, there have been a number of events in support of saving the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal. In the last few weeks in New York City, more than 6,000 people crowded into Madison Square Garden. In last September 1999, the Artist Network had events around the country called Mumia 911 for September 11th. This is excerpts of one event that took place in Los Angeles. Ed Asner was one of the MCs, and he was followed by Roscoe Lee Brown, the actor. Ed Asner.
I'd like to have you all know that the latest edition of Vanity Fair includes a letter from Mumia in response to the hatchet job they did. And if I may quickly read it to you so you can be apprised of it. Once again, we hear about a so-called confession. But instead of 2 months later, this comes over a decade later. We don't hear it from a priest, from a lawyer, or from a personal friend, but from an official visitor of the Pennsylvania Prison Society over 10 years later. A lie is a lie, whether made today or 10 years later. But I suppose Philip Block, the prison volunteer who claimed that Abu Jamal confessed to him, wanted his 15 minutes of fame, in which case I hope he has received it. I find it remarkable that this rumor turned lie was never brought to my attention by the author, by Mr. Block himself, or by Vanity Fair magazine, which never contacted me. Welcome to snuff journalism. I look forward to the state's producing this witness, Mr. Block, after I am granted a new trial. The only thing worse than a forgotten confession is one allegedly born on the false wings of harassment. If ever one needed proof of the state's desperation, here it is. I thank Vanity Fair not for its work, but for stoking this controversy, because controversy leads to questioning, and one can only question this belated confession. Mumia Abu Jamal.
The second is a poem that is the one that I mentioned before that Mumia, I believe, has read. I know it was sent to him by the poet Lance Jeffers. And I'm so glad that Mr. Phillips spoke about that hand that can pluck you and descend upon you. This poem is about hand also. And just think, please, that the poet may mean the hand that shakes another hand in a certain bond. It may mean the hand of an artist as he paints or sculpts or acts. It can be the hand whose fingers obey the bidding of one's mind and heart as one writes. It can be the hand that is clutched in a fist, meaning might. And consider, please, that black in this instance may be a metaphor for white, red, brown, yellow. I do not know the power of my hand. I do not know the power of my black hand. I sit slumped in the conviction that I am powerless, tolerate ceilings that make me bend. My godly mind stoops. My ambition is crippled. I do not know the power of my hand. I see my children stunted, my young men slaughtered. I do not know the mighty power of my black hand. I see the power over my life and death in another man's hands. And sometimes I shake my woolly head and wonder, Lord, have mercy. What would it be like to be free? But when I know the mighty power of my hand, I will snatch my freedom from the tyrant's mouth, know the first taste of freedom on my eager tongue, sing the miracle of freedom with all the force of my lungs, christen my black land with exuberant creation, stand independent in the whole of nations, root submission from the soil of my soul, and pitch the monument of slavery from my back. when I know the mighty power of my hand.
Actor Roscoe Lee Brown, at an event September 11th, 1999, called Mumia 911 in Los Angeles. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, more of the recorded commentaries of the death row prisoner himself, as well as those who support him. In the last segment, we'll go to Ramona Africa in Philadelphia, the lone survivor of the Moon bombing that took place 15 years ago. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On May 13, 1985, 15 years ago, Philadelphia police dropped a firebomb on the MOVE headquarters. MOVE, a radical black organization that loudly criticized police brutality and the government. Six children were killed and five adults. At the time, Mumia Abu-Jamal was in prison on death row. He had been convicted in 1982 of killing a white police officer, Daniel Faulkner, in a that many human rights organizations have called deeply flawed. Right now, his case is being considered by a federal judge, one of the first times out of the state court system. And his supporters are calling on the judge to allow for an evidentiary hearing. In the last segment of the show, we're going to go to the only survivor, adult survivor, of the MOVE bombing, Ramona Africa. But in this segment, we're going to hear more from the supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as from the recorded commentaries of the death row prisoner himself. While it is a dead serious issue, last September in Los Angeles at an Artist Network event called Mumia 911, comedian Paula Poundstone, brought some levity to the event.
Thank you very much. I feel a little guilty. I actually had never heard of the Mumia cause until Ed called me, and he didn't tell me anything about the fraternal police thing or whatever, with the courage and the threats or something. Nothing was mentioned of that. I specifically remember saying to him, Ed, this is a very mainstream kind of thing to do, isn't it? And his eyes shifted back and forth, and he said, yeah. I said, this has the approval of the government, doesn't it, Ed? And he said, yes, and that's the capacity in which I'm calling you. So a lot of this surprises me a little bit. I felt so embarrassed earlier when you were introducing Roscoe because you said, we have with us tonight the voice of the century, and my butt was about 4 or 5 inches off the chair before I realized that he meant Roscoe Lee Brown, with whom at many events I have shared that title. I remember early on in my work with Roscoe when he came to me saying, how exactly should I read this piece? And I said, Roscoe, try to use a big voice. And he had a little tinny, almost a vibrato thing happening. And we worked and we worked. I don't know how many of you ever saw My Fair Lady, but it was very much like that. I remember. He almost swallowed a marble, honest to God. We worked and toiled. You know, I'm always embarrassed also to be at an event like this, even as an audience member, because I like poetry and I've very much enjoyed what I've heard tonight, but I do much better as an audience member when someone says, the end. The fear that I live in of beginning to applaud too early, it's the same reason I don't go to museums, you know? I go and I look at a picture and I go, geez, that's really great. And I step away. And I always feel that there's a group somewhere that says, she didn't get it. They're kind of looking at me askance, going, you know, it doesn't even kick in until 20 minutes. I've just, I don't know, poetry's, it's bigger than me, really. Nothing. And thank God they went over how to pronounce the guy's name. I heard the tapes of the stuff that I guess NPR chose not to play. Radio guy, why did they decide not to do that?
Pressure.
Pressure?
There was pressure on them not to run the commentaries of a man convicted of killing a police officer.
From whom did the pressure come? Oh, great. Thank you again, Ed Asner. If NPR can't take pressure, what the hell made you think I could? If they give me even an itsy bit of pressure, I'm calling you. That's all there is to it. I listened to the pieces last night, and there's a CD out of it, which I'm not telling you. I'm looking for your concurrence as I say it. I'm not informing the radio guy of the fact that a CD exists. How did you become the radio guy there?
I was fired from somewhere else.
You were fired from somewhere else? You know, there was probably pressure. That would be my guess. All right. I'm also probably the only atheist here tonight, which makes me really comfortable. Nothing. The good thing about being an atheist, are you, Roscoe? Oh, thank God. People, a lot of times that offends people when I say that I'm an atheist, but I think the good news there, I still go to church, I'm not a heathen. I go to an atheist church where crippled guys stand up and testify that they were crippled and still are. It's the only church in the world where 100 bottles of beer on the a wall, is it him? No, the good thing about being an atheist that can comfort those of you who aren't is that we atheists have no mandate to convert anyone. So you're not going to be awakened on a Saturday morning by me at your doorbell. Hi, good morning. Just stop by to tell you there is no word. I have this little blank book that I was hoping you'd take a look at when you get some time. I died once I guess my heart stopped for a minute, and I can tell you this about death. There is no bright light, and there's nobody waving you anywhere. Unless, of course, there's a one-minute waiting period that I'm not familiar with, or unless my friends and loved ones are avoiding me even in death. Cover the light, cover the light! I was just curious. I mean, I know why. Okay, I get why the celebrity people are here. But I was wondering, for example, for example, the guy in the striped shirt, straight back, what's your involvement with the organization? When I say the guy with a striped shirt, if you're not sure if you have a striped shirt on or not, that would be the time to look down. Are you from the Fraternal Order of Police?
No.
No. How did you happen to hear about tonight?
Read about it in the paper.
Read about it in the paper? What paper?
The LA Times.
Get out. I don't read the paper, which is probably why I didn't. I'm one of those kind of head in the sand people. The print gets on my fingers, and I've never liked that. I like a story that continues from page one to page two. The thing of getting just past the fold and then stopping makes no sense to me. It's too big. It's crinkly. And I was recently diagnosed with an obsessive compulsive disorder. I can never reassemble it properly. I panic about the recycling. It's just too much for me. So I wait for a phone call from Ed, and that seems to be how I get most of my information. I do have kids, actually. I am a foster parent, which, for those of you who have ever considered it and thought perhaps that you were ineligible for some reason, I am a certified foster parent, and that should make most of you worthy. You don't have to be married, and you don't have to have a lot of money.
In every phase and facet of national life, there is a war being waged on America's poor. In social policy, poor mothers are targeted for criminal sanctions for acts, if committed by mothers of higher economic class, would merit treatment at the Betty Ford Center. In youth policy, governments hasten to close schools while building boot camps and prisons as their graduate schools. Xenophobic politicians hoist campaigns through the dark star of imprisonment for street beggars, further fattening the fortress economy. The only apparent solution to the scourge of homelessness is to build more and more prisons. In America's 90s, to be poor is not so much socioeconomic status as it is a serious character flaw, a defect of the spirit. Federal statistics tell a tale of loss and want so dreadful that Dickens, of A Tale of Two Cities fame, would cringe. Consider 7 million people homeless with less than $200 in monthly income. 37 million people, 14.5% of the nation's population, living below poverty levels. Of that number, 29% are African Americans, meaning over 10.6 million blacks living in poverty. Both wings of the ruling Republican Party try to outdo themselves in announcing new, ever more draconian measures to restrict, redress, restrain, and to eliminate the poor. One is reminded of the wry observation of French writer Anatole France: the law, in its majestic equality, forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. Already, U.S. manufacturers have fled to NAFTA-friendly Mexico, and only the Zapatista insurgency in Chiapas has slowed an emerging flood of Western capital. Outgunned in the industrial wars by Japan and Germany, the U.S. has embarked on a low-technology, low-skilled, high-employment scheme that exploits the poor, the stupid, and the slow via a boom in prison construction, America's sole growth industry. Increasingly, more and more Americans are guarding more and more American prisoners for more and more years, and this amidst the lowest crime rate in decades. No major political party has an answer to this social dilemma, short of cages and graves for the poor. The time is ripe for a new, brighter, life-affirming vision that liberates, not represses, the poor, who, after all, are the vast majority of this earth's people. neither serpentine politics nor a sterile economic theory which treats them, people, as mere economic units, offer much hope, for the very politicians they vote for spit in their faces, while economists write them off as non-persons. It must come from the poor, a rebellion of the spirit that reaffirms their intrinsic human worth based upon who they are rather than what they possess. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I'm Asada Shakur. The first time I heard a tape of one of Mumia's radio broadcasts, it was the first time I fully understood why the United States government was so intent on putting him to death. Mumia, the only African political prisoner on death row, didn't use any inflammatory rhetoric. What he said was so clear, so true, that I had to stop everything and concentrate on his message. Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist, husband, father, he is brilliant. He has the ability to say what needs to be said in the clearest, most vivid way. His language, his strength, and his intelligence remind me of one man, El-Haj Malik Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a man who has truly carried on Malcolm's tradition and the tradition of so many of our freedom fighters who have risked their lives for the freedom of our people. This year, as I celebrated Malcolm's birthday, I couldn't stop thinking about Mumia. I couldn't stop thinking about the man who has spent over 15 years on death row and remains strong, committed, and beautiful. Mumia, political activist, revolutionary, and humanist, has followed faithfully in Malcolm's footsteps. We can feel Malcolm's energy working through Mumia. We can feel Mumia's energy carrying on Malcolm's legacy. If Malcolm X were alive today, I know he would be fighting to save Mumia's life. If Malcolm were alive today, I know he would be fighting to free all political prisoners. In the name of Malcolm X, I make a special appeal to you, sisters and brothers, to fight tooth and nail to save Mumia's life.
American mass media is a marvel of technology. It is whiz-bang, sparkle glitter, and satellite wizardry. It is a master plan of methods to communicate in a pauper's worth of substance. With such technology, how are people so woefully misinformed? The average American neither knows nor cares about the vast world beyond the nation's border. The average American student knows little math, no history, and very little geography, and nor does he or she want to know. Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly. On November 2nd, 1995, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly, 117-3, to condemn the United States for its continuing blockade of Cuba. The international community called the United States blockade a flagrant act of aggression and a blatant violation of international law. That the UN vote was reported at all in American media is amazing, for such news is more often than not passed over entirely by the American press. But where was information about the blockade itself, the effects suffered by the Cuban people, in-depth comments from United Nations delegates and leaders around the world? For a more substantive report, one had to listen to the BBC World News Service, for the rest of the world takes note of events the U.S. prefers to ignore. American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them. Every media enterprise in America reports the drivel that Marcia Clark and Chris Darden are secret lovebirds, but the vote of a global assembly condemning U.S. actions received only scant coverage at best. Why? The media is a source of titillation more than information. The mission of the media is to please, to comfort, and primarily to sell. When TV was developed,
it was promised that every American would learn about the world in his living room. When computers were developed, wasn't it said that they would be invaluable learning tools and that children would learn more faster? National scholastic tests show otherwise, as kids master computers as toys and learn splendid hand-to-eye coordination, but little else. The media paints false pictures of the nation and the world, pictures designed to serve corporate masters and to make America look good. This feel-good media approach serves the American delusion of white supremacy, but it does not inform. When the New York Times echoes the National Star, what can the word media mean? How could millions be surprised at Minister Farrakhan's enormous influence among blacks unless the media wasn't doing its job? How could they look at a million and count less than half that number? The major media, like its racist projections, is to be rejected, not consumed, for your very patronage gives it life. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This past weekend was the 15th anniversary of the MOVE bombing. That's when Philadelphia police dropped a firebomb on the house of the MOVE organization, May 13, 1985, killing 6 children and 5 adults. MOVE was a radical Philadelphia-based group that often protested police brutality and the government overall. Despite a special commission finding that top Philadelphia officials were grossly negligent and 2 grand jury investigations, no one from city government ever was criminally charged.
Is it a confrontation?
It most certainly is a confrontation, one strategized by Giant Africa years and years and years ago.
There's been talk that there are explosives in this house. Is there any truth to that?
That's only people's, hallucination, because they have not been inside this house, so they would not know what is in this house. What is in this house is the strategy of John Africa that is very explosive.
The final point I gave to the police commissioner was, take your time, prepare a good plan. We can then proceed with a tremendous amount of order.
Are you positive that you told the mayor that you were going to use explosive charges?
Yes, sir, I did.
Did the mayor seem to you to be paying attention to what you were saying?
Yes, sir.
Did
because he asked me if it was safe.
Did you know prior to hearing the automatic gunfire that the police would be in possession of and possibly using automatic weapons?
I knew they would have M16s.
Did you know they'd have Uzis?
I did not.
Did you know they'd have 50 caliber weapons present?
I did not.
Okay. Did you know that they'd have an anti-tank gun?
I did not.
Did you know they'd have an M60?
I did not.
We intend to evict from the house, we intend to evacuate from the house, and we intend to seize control of the house. We will do it by any means necessary.
Ramona Africa is the only adult to have survived the blaze, the police firebombing of the Move Row House. She was awarded $500,000 from the city, $400,000 for pain and suffering, $100,000 for disfigurement from burns suffered in the fire. She escaped with a 13-year-old boy, then known as Birdie Africa, by crawling through a basement window. She served 7 years in prison on a riot charge. Ramona Africa, can you go back to that day 15 years ago?
I can remember that day like it happened today. It actually began on Sunday, Mother's Day, May 12th. That's when the police came out to our home, setting up, you know, water cannons, setting up high-powered artillery weapons, and, you know, planning to kill Move. This was not about an arrest. This was about murder. And the government tried to convince people that the reason they came out there was because some of our neighbors complained about us. And people should feel insulted by that, Amy. You should feel insulted by that because you know that this government does not care about black people complaining about their neighbors. Since when? You know? And they want people to believe that a handful of black people complained about their neighbors, and the FBI, the ATF got involved in this assault. When does the FBI get involved in a neighborhood dispute? It was obvious more to it, you know, than that. What this was about was the government's attempt to silence our protest over the ongoing imprisonments of the Move 9, our 9 Move sisters and brothers that have been in prison since 1978. Unjustly for a murder they didn't commit. And the government sent hundreds of cops out to our home to silence our protest, to stop us from exposing them. That's what the May 13th bombing was about. After turning deluges on us, after using tear gas against us, after shooting over 10,000 rounds of bullets in on us within 90 minutes, they decided that wasn't enough. And they concocted two bombs. They wanted a backup bomb. And they got a state police helicopter, flew over our home with no warning at all, no announcement, no nothing, and dropped that bomb on the roof of our home. The bomb ignited a fire, which the fire department, police officials, all officials refused to put out. Even though they had put tons of water on our home, you know, prior to there being a fire. When we realized that our home was on fire, we made every attempt to get our children, our animals, and ourselves out of that blazing inferno. We were hollering that we're coming out, that we're bringing the kids out. The kids were hollering. And the response, the only response we got, was a barrage of police gunfire deliberately aimed at us to stop us from escaping that blazing inferno. As a result, 11 people, 5 babies, and 6 adults burnt alive and found to have bullet fragments in them from the police shooting at us. I am the only adult to survive that, and I was able to get one little boy out. But while, you know, we want people to never, ever forget what happened that day, what is important now is that this government cannot give us back our family members that they murdered, but they can be pressured to give us back our innocent family members that are alive, that they have in prison. And that's what we're pushing for. The contradiction is so blatant, it slaps you in the face. In August of 1978, hundreds of cops came out to our home to kill Move people. In their frenzy to kill Move people, one of their own cops was shot, obviously not by Move. Yet 9 Move people went to prison for a total of 900 years, 100 years each, for the one cop. Fast forward 7 years later, to May 13th of 1985, and the police again come out to our home to attack us and end up killing 11 MOVE people, five of them babies. Nobody goes to prison except MOVE, except me. There is something very wrong with this picture, very wrong. The government wants to label Mumia a murderer and scream for his blood, say that he murdered one cop. Well, they murdered 11 MOVE people. Why is it that none of those responsible for murdering innocent babies are sitting on death row next to Mumia? Not that we advocate or endorse death row, but they do. They do. So, you know, right now, our activity is to expose this contradiction, to expose the government, and push for the release of our family while never letting people forget what happened on May 13th, 1985. We travel literally around the world. We've been all over France, all over Italy, all over Germany, all over Belgium. We've been to the Netherlands, to French Guiana in South America. We've been all over England. And, you know, putting the information out, spreading the word, we've spoken at Harvard, Radcliffe, Cornell, UCLA, Vassar College, the University of Penn, all of these prestigious Ivy League colleges, this information is getting out. I just spoke last week at Kent State University for the 30th anniversary of the massacre of those students at Kent State. And what people are beginning to see is the thread that ties all of this together. We're talking about state-sponsored terrorism, police terrorism, and it is not only affecting poor black people, it's not only affecting activists, revolutionaries, but it's affecting middle-class white America. It's affecting people who have, you know, no part in revolutionary activity. What I discovered at Kent State is that only one of those four students that was murdered was even involved in the demonstration. The other three were simply going to class when the National Guard went crazy. Right now, you got the government just bombing like crazy in Vieques. You have the government getting ready to shed the blood of yet more indigenous people out there at Big Mountain in Arizona. I mean, when is it going to stop?
Ramona,
it's only going to stop when we the people make it stop. And that's MOVE's message, that we have to make it stop.
Ramona Africa, what was it like inside in that day that ended up in the death of 11 people that you knew well, children and adults? What was happening inside as the pressure mounted outside? The video cameras were only showing us, or the movie cameras at that time were only showing us what was happening outside.
Well, we were fully occupied with trying to save ourselves, our children, and even our animals. I mean, we were being flooded with water. The water was pouring from the roof all the way down to the basement. I mean, we were in the basement, and the water was pouring down on us. So we were, you know, trying to take care of our children, our animals, and ourselves. Then when they shot in all of that tear gas, we had to take care of our children and, you know, the animals. We were given a strategy by John Africa, you know, to help us and protect us. And we use that. You know, obviously we're not going to, you know, divulge what that is. But we used it. And then, you know, when you hear high-powered artillery coming at you, 50-caliber machine guns, M60 automatic rifles, sniper rifles, you know, some with silencers. I mean, it was frightening. It was terrifying, which is why we're saying it is, in fact, police terrorism.
The police said that
it was absolutely frightening. You didn't think you were going to, you know, get out of there alive.
The police said that there were gunshots coming from inside. What's your response to that?
Oh, certainly they're going to say that. I mean, what would you expect them to say, that we never shot at them? They said that we fired on them with automatic weapons. They never found. They went all through the rubble that they created, and they could not find one single automatic weapon.
Ramona,
federal suit that I filed against the city of Philadelphia and specific individuals, firemen testified. They were asked specifically over and over, you know, if they saw any gunshots coming from MOVE, heard any gunshots coming from MOVE, and they answered, no, not a shot.
The man who gave the okay for the bombing, Wilson Good, who was mayor of Philadelphia at that time, is now a reverend. Any comments?
Well, if that's what he calls religion, I don't want it.
What happened with your civil suit?
With my civil suit? What happened is after 11 years, it finally went to trial in 1996. And with the federal jury, you know, which was gathered from around the state, it was a predominantly white jury. There were only two people of color on the jury. And they sat through that trial for like 2.5 months, heard all the evidence, heard all the testimony. And what they did was they found the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, and the city of Philadelphia liable. And the judge did not like that and just basically threw the juror's verdict out the window and granted immunity to the police commissioner and the fire commissioner.
After the verdict?
After the jury had found them liable.
After the verdict?
After the verdict. It's unheard of. It is unheard of. And this is what they call justice in the United States. And is there any wonder, you know, why people are shot down by police like Amadou Diallo, or assaulted like Abner Louima?
Ramona Africa is the only adult survivor of the police bombing of the MOVE organization in Philadelphia 15 years ago. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Jeremy Scahill, and Maria Carrion. Ramona Africa is the only adult survivor of the police bombing of the MOVE organization. It killed 11 people, 6 children, 5 adults, and burned down more than 60 houses in the neighborhood of Philadelphia. This was May 13th, 1985. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love, Jeremy Scahill, and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!